information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care, and it shows.
The law?
Country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
The government believed they were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
Check, check, check. Welcome, my friends, to episode 65 of Media Monarchy, coming to you February 29th, 2008. It's Leap Day, and I've got mind-bending news for you on this week's episode. Hillary, a hollowed-out book, the NAU, and UK fraudsters, cloud seedings, seed bank quake, B2 crash, Billboard Liberation Front. We've got all the latest on 9/11, DNA warnings, contradictions, confrontations, documentation, ProQuad, Prozac, DuPont, Doomsday, EOL, and UN Sex. We got Robot Wars, SAIC, Target Cities, LRADs, Vampire Cams, Warships, Watch List, Kosovo Colony, Shooter Drills, China's One Child, War Game, Pollution Olympics. It's all on episode 65. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster, MediaMonarchy.com. Claxons, Totem on the Timeline from the record Myths of the Near Future. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. This is episode 65, coming to you Leap Day, February 29th, 2008. Coming to you live, as always, Friday mornings at 10 Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, thanks to revereradionetwork.com. And you can, of course, hit me up, make a friend out of me, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, and iTunes. Radioforall.net and archive.org is where you can get the podcast. So I thank you for getting it. And there's a lot to get to, so let's get it on. U.S. sends warships to Eastern Mediterranean. U.S. sending three warships to Eastern Mediterranean as regional tensions mount. This is coming from AP News. Yesterday, the 28th, the U.S. Navy is sending three ships to the Eastern Mediterranean Sea in a show of strength during a period of tensions with Syria and political uncertainty in Lebanon. Admiral Michael Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters the deployment should not be viewed as threatening or in response to events in any single country in that volatile region. "This is an area that is important to us, the Eastern Med," he said when asked about news reports of the ship's movements. "It's a group of ships that will operate in the vicinity there for a while," adding that it isn't meant to send stronger signals than that, but it does signal that we're engaged, we're going to be in the vicinity, and that's a very, very important part of the world. Another military officer speaking on condition of anonymity because full details about the ship movements are not yet public, said a Navy-guided missile destroyer, the one and only USS Cole, was headed for patrol in the Eastern Mediterranean and that the USS Nassau, an amphibious warship, would be joining it shortly. The officer said a third ship would go later, but he didn't identify by type or name. The U.S. 6th Fleet, whose area of operations includes the entire Mediterranean, is based at Naples, Italy. The decision to send the ships appeared to be a not-too-subtle show of U.S. force in the region as international frustration mounts over a long political deadlock in tiny, weak Lebanon. The U.S. blames Syria for the impasse, saying Syria has never given up its ambitions to control its smaller neighbor. The presidential election in Lebanon has been delayed 15 times. And just this last week, the date was pushed back again to March 11th, and good old USS Condoleezza Rice, not her Unocal tanker, she's set to visit the Middle East next week. And there's links in there, and you can read about the rebuilt USS Cole. And we don't have to speculate here about what it means sending that ship back to that region. But if we jump to threat level, U.S. terror watch list surpasses 900,000 names. The government's centralized terrorist watch list passed the 900,000 name mark this month, according to the ACLU, which estimated the new total by relying on congressional testimony from the fall that the sprawling list was growing by 20,000 names a month. The report the ACLU relied on to create its watch list counter, with a link for you there, included the following chart that's included in this post that basically shows a line going up and up and up and up and up. The Terrorist Screening Center runs the list, accepting nominations of new names from a large range of government agencies. Agencies use the watch list to check persons seeking visas, travelers entering or leaving the country, domestic airline passengers, and persons stopped by state, local, or federal law enforcement. That would pretty much be anyone, anywhere. Most of the positive matches on the list came from police routinely checking persons such as speeding motorists, according to the GAO's report, with a PDF for you. The number of individuals on the list is likely significantly less than 900,000 since the name count includes aliases. Persons on the list are coded with varying suspected threat levels, so simply being on the watch list doesn't mean one will be arrested when, say, a person on the list pulled over for speeding. In fact, being on the list isn't even enough to ensure that a person is denied a visa or entry into the country. So what's the list for? The TSA exports two subsets of the list, the no-fly and the selectee lists, which airlines use to decide who can get a boarding pass and who has to get hand-groped. The TSA continues to work on a much-delayed project now known as Secure Flight that would have the TSA perform the name checks in advance of a domestic flight, in an effort to reduce the number of falsely flagged travelers. Those affected over the last 7 years include many David Nelsons, a high-ranking nun, and federal employees with security clearances. If the ACLU's math is correct, the list should pass the million mark sometime in early July. And that goes on, and there's updates and there's links to all that documentation. But I don't know if you can find out if you are on the list. Let's jump to globalresearch.ca, Center for Research on Globalization. An article written by Sarah Flounders. Washington gets a new colony in the Balkans. Now, we, of course, last week's episode 64 started out with the burning embassy in Belgrade. Building on this, Washington gets a new colony in the Balkans. In evaluating the recent declaration of independence by Kosovo, a province of Serbia, and its immediate recognition as a state by the U.S., Germany, Britain, and France, it's important to know three things. First, Kosovo is not gaining independence or even minimal self-government. It will be run by an appointed high representative and bodies appointed by the U.S., EU, and NATO. Secondly, Washington's immediate recognition of Kosovo confirms once again that U.S. imperialism will break any and every treaty or international agreement it has ever signed, including agreements it drafted and imposed by force and violence on others. Thirdly, U.S. imperialist domination does not benefit the occupied people. Kosovo, after 9 years of direct NATO military occupation, has a staggering 60% unemployment rate, and it's become a center of international drug trade and of prostitution rings in Europe. Jumping down, in 1991, while world attention was focused on the devastating U.S. bombing of Iraq, Part 1, Washington encouraged, financed, and armed right-wing separatist movements in the Croatian, Slovenian, and Bosnian republics of the Yugoslav Federation. In violation of international agreements, Germany and the U.S. gave quick recognition to these secessionist movements and approved the creation of several capitalist mini-states. At the same time, U.S. finance capital imposed severe economic sanctions on Yugoslavia to bankrupt its economy. The arming and financing of the right-wing UCK movement in the Serbian province of Kosovo began in the same period. Washington initiated a wild propaganda campaign claiming that Serbia was carrying out a campaign of massive genocide against the Albanian majority in Kosovo. U.S. NATO officials under the Clinton administration issued an outrageous ultimatum that Serbia immediately accept military occupation and surrender all sovereignty or face NATO bombardment of its cities. What did they get? 78 days of 35,000 cluster bombs, thousands of rounds of radioactive depleted uranium, bunker busters, cruise missiles. The bombing destroyed 480 schools, 33 hospitals, health clinics, bridges, industrial, chemical, heating plants, and the electrical grid. Finally, on June 3, 1999, Yugoslavia was forced to agree to a ceasefire and the occupation of Kosovo. Expecting to find bodies everywhere, forensic teams from 17 NATO countries organized by the Hague Tribunal on War Crimes searched all over occupied Kosovo for the summer of 99, but found no evidence of massacres or of mass graves or genocide. We can read more about the 2008 Kosovo Declaration of Independence. You can hit up Wikipedia or a million different news sources. If we look at some of the reactions, United States President George W. Bush welcomed the Declaration of Independence as well as its proclamation of friendship with Serbia, stating, quote, "We have strongly supported the plan," implying Kosovo's independence. "We are heartened by the blah-bitty-blah-blah." Russia, however, reacted with condemnation, stating they expect the UN mission and NATO-led forces in Kosovo to take immediate action to carry out their mandate, including the annulling of the decisions of the self-governing organs and the taking of tough administrative measures against them. You can follow that story and, of course, see all the latest accusations of Russia and bloodshed and missile defenses and all of that. But we're going to shift gears and jump to the Charlotte Observer. As you know, we have tons and tons of lone nutter shooters, copycat effect happening massively. I would not be surprised if we saw another one today on the 29th. But the Charlotte Observer has an article, "Armed Intruder Drill Terrifies University Class." Last Friday, an intruder entered a classroom in Moore Hall at Elizabeth City State University, ECSU, and pointed what appeared to be a gun at assistant principal Jingbin Wang. The man ordered students in Wang's American foreign policy class to line up against a wall and threatened to kill the student with the lowest GPA. I was prepared to die, Wang recalled. 10 minutes after the siege began, police stormed the class and subdued the intruder. His weapon, it turned out, was red and plastic, a fake. So was the entire incident. Anthony Brown, Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, says the university in the northeast corner of the state was testing its response to shootings that have shaken campuses across the country. The intent was not to frighten them, but to test our system, and also to test the response of security. The drill was conducted 8 days after a gunman stormed a Northern Illinois University classroom, killing 5 before killing himself. Brown said students, staff, and faculty were notified 5 days in advance that a drill would take place. The word, he said, went out via email and text messages. Not everyone got the word. And we can look at the story that's on Elizabeth City's website. ECSU tests emergency preparedness plan. And that's just the straight up press release whitewash. It's kind of fucked up to say, but I almost wish, I don't know what their concealed carry or gun laws are there, but if a student in that class, in that situation, stood up and blasted the supposed shooter. Sorry. Jumping to Reuters, shifting gears yet again, U.S. Air Force B-2 bomber crashes, and the pilots are okay. Dateline Guam, a U.S. B-2 stealth bomber crashed at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam just after taking off, but the two pilots on board ejected safely. They've been evaluated by medical authorities and are in good condition. An inquiry will be held into why the craft, which costs almost $1.2 billion each, crashed. Guam, a U.S. Pacific territory within striking distance of regional hotspots, has had a bomber presence since March 04, and B-52s, B-2s, and B-1s deploy on rotation from bases on the U.S. mainland. The aircraft, which crashed, was based at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. The B-2 bomber can evade most radar signals, making it difficult for defensive systems to detect, track an attack. So, what's the deal, Northrop Grumman? As we'll get to at the end of the episode, Northrop Grumman was on MediaMonarchy.com reading about the crash of their B-2 Spirit. The Northrop Grumman B-2 Spirit is a multi-role stealth heavy bomber capable of deploying both conventional and nuclear weapons. It is operated exclusively by the United States Air Force. And you can read more about the incident and other crashes and things. But if we jump to PressTV.ir, coming out of Iran, France, United Arab Emirates, Qatar begin war games. So France, Qatar, and the UAE begin joint military exercises involving land, sea, and air forces in the Persian Gulf region. The military war games began last Saturday and are to continue for several days, the official WAM news agency reported. The exact location of the military training, which is part of the Persian Gulf Shield maneuvers held regularly by France and the UAE, was not revealed. The UAE and France announced a defense agreement following the 91 Persian Gulf War I, but this is the first time Qatar is taking part in the exercises. The pact, concluded in 95, allows for regular joint maneuvers by units from the two countries' armed forces. Last month, Paris signed a deal during President Nicolas Sarkozy's visit to the UAE to build a permanent military base in the country. Now, the official WAM news agency, the Emirates news agency, is at wam.org.ae. Dateline Abu Dhabi, the UAE, Qatar, and France begin joint military exercises here today as part of Gulf Shield 1. So that's the name of the military drill, Gulf Shield 1. And you want to Google that and follow it down the hole of military war games. Jumping back to the UK, guardian.co.uk, government wants personal details of every traveler. Passengers traveling between EU countries or taking domestic flights would have to hand over a mass of personal information, including their mobile phone numbers and credit card details, as part of a new package of security measures being demanded by the British government. The data would be stored for 13 years and used to profile suspects. Brussels officials are already considering controversial anti-terror plans that would collect up to 19 pieces of information on every air passenger entering or leaving the EU. Under a controversial agreement reached last summer with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the EU already supplies the same information, 19 pieces, to Washington for all passengers flying between Europe and the U.S. But Britain wants the system extended to sea and rail travel to be applied to domestic flights and those between EU countries. According to a questionnaire circulated to all EU capitals by the European Commission, the UK is the only country of 27 EU member states that wants the system used for more general public policy purposes besides fighting terrorism and crime. The so-called passenger name record system, which we'll hit up in a second, proposed by the Commission and supported by most EU governments, has been denounced by civil libertarians and data protection officials as draconian and probably ineffective. So if we jump to passenger name record, PNR, in the travel industry, a PNR is a record in the database of a computer reservation system, CRS, that contains the travel record for a passenger or a group of passengers traveling together. The concept of a PNR was first introduced by airlines that needed to exchange reservation information in case passengers required flights of multiple airlines to reach their destination. And of course, what starts out being reasonable ends up getting rolled up in the massive spy state, police state, nanny state that has fully taken over the UK and is rapidly enveloping the US. Last week in Dallas, and we've reported things like this before on MediaMonarchy.com, and it's basically how death surrounds both the Bush and Clinton crime families. So last weekend, there was a Dallas cop, a motorcycle cop, who was killed while escorting Hillary Clinton.
Campaign 08 took a tragic turn today. A motorcycle police officer died while escorting Hillary Clinton's motorcade. CBS political reporter Dave Bryant.
Laura, a stunning moment on the campaign trail today when a motorcycle officer escorting Hillary Clinton died after that accident you mentioned. This came the morning after the Texas Democratic debate, where they're still sifting through charges of plagiarism. Hillary Clinton's motorcade in Dallas this morning passed by the scene of a deadly accident. A Dallas police motorcycle officer on escort duty ahead of Clinton crashed and later died in a hospital. Clinton spoke in Dallas, then cut short this rally in Fort Worth to visit the officer's family.
I know that our thoughts and our prayers are with his family and those with whom he served on a daily basis to protect the people of Dallas.
The tragedy overshadowed the immediate aftermath of last night's debate between Clinton and Barack Obama. Clinton was ready for a question about Obama's borrowed rhetoric.
You know, lifting whole passages from someone else's speeches is not change you can believe in, it's change you can Xerox in.
This is where we start getting into silly season in politics.
It's also where the Obama campaign charged Clinton herself got into lifting applause lines, starting with one John Edwards said in a December debate and posted today on YouTube.
All of us are going to be just fine, no matter what happens in this election. But what's at stake is whether America is going to be fine.
Whatever happens, we're going to be fine. You know, we have strong support from our families and our friends. I just hope that we'll be able to say the same thing about the American people.
And internet bloggers claimed they found another line on loan, this one from candidate Bill Clinton in 1992.
When the history of this campaign is written, they may say, well, Bill Clinton took a lot of hits in this campaign. I want you to know something. Hits that I took in this election, nothing compared to the hits that the people of this state and this country are taking every day of their lives under this administration.
You know, the hits I've taken in life are nothing compared to what goes on every single day in the lives of people across our country.
Meanwhile, Republican John McCain today defended the integrity of lobbyists who were running his presidential campaign and said he was through talking about the New York Times story alleging an improper relationship with a woman lobbyist. At the same time, a federal grand jury indicted Arizona Congressman Rick Renzi, who co-chairs McCain's campaign in his home state. Dave Bryan, CBS 2 News.
The phony left and the phony right and all their latest scandals and plagiarism and graft and affairs. All I gotta say is RonPaul2008.com. But we're going to press forward now on this 65th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. This is coming from the Tampa Tribune out of Florida. Tampa International Airport passenger had a box cutter in a hollowed-out book. Dateline Tampa, a 21-year-old Clearwater man. Clearwater, interesting to note, is, of course, the big home of Scientology. A 21-year-old Clearwater man was arrested at Tampa International Airport this weekend after security personnel found a box cutter in a hollowed-out book. If convicted, Baines faces up to 10 years in prison and up to $250,000 fine for a federal charge of attempting to board an airplane with a concealed dangerous weapon. He's currently serving a 30-day sentence after pleading guilty Monday to a state misdemeanor charge of carrying a concealed weapon. About 7:30 a.m. Sunday, airport security ran Benjamin Baines Jr.'s backpack through an X-ray machine and saw the image of a box cutter. While searching the backpack, a security officer found a book titled Fear Itself. The book was hollowed out and the box cutter was inside. After Baines was read his rights, he said his cousin had cut away the pages to make the hollow section in the book. Later reports state he said he had hollowed it out himself to hide money and marijuana from his roommates, which you gotta do sometimes. Baines told officers he was moving to Vegas and forgot the cutter was in the book. Officers found books in the backpack titled Muhammad and the Bible, The Prophet's Prayer, and the Noble Quran. He also had a copy of the Quran and the Bible. Several sheets of paper in the backpack included rap lyrics that referred to police, narcotics, weapons, and killing. Baines told officers he's a rapper who writes his own lyrics and that rap music writers need to, quote, play the part. Shifting gears big time yet again, this coming from many, many places. We'll first hit Gazette.com. And I may have made brief reference to this last week, but it's Canada.com. And the growing North American Union, U.S. and Canada to work together in crises. The United States and Canada have inked an agreement to help one another during civil emergencies. Air Force General Jean Renault, commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, and NORTHCOM, based at Peterson Air Force Base, and Canadian Air Force Lieutenant General Mark Dumais, D-U-M-A-I-S, Canada Command commander signed the pact last week. The, quote, Civil Assistance Plan allows the military from one nation to support the armed forces of the other nation. This document is a unique bilateral military plan to align our respective national military plans to respond quickly to the other nation's request for military support of civil authorities. The agreement allows mutual assistance during floods, forest fires, hurricanes, earthquakes, and, of course, terrorist attacks. Dumais said the plan underscores the two nations' existing working relationship evidenced by the Joint Command, NORAD. The plan recognizes the role of each nation's lead federal agency for emergency preparedness. For the U.S., it's Homeland Security, and in Canada, Public Safety Canada. The plan facilitates the military-to-military support of civil authorities after government authorities agree on a response. And it should be noted that NORTHCOM was established on October 1st, 2002, and CanadaCOM was set up on February 1st, 2006. And those were at least when they decided to announce it to us. If we jump to Canada.com, CanWest News Service, Canada-U.S. agreed to use each other's troops in civil emergencies. Canada and the U.S. have signed an agreement that paves the way for the militaries from either nation to send troops across each other's borders during an emergency. But some are questioning why the Harper government has kept silent on the deal. Neither the Canadian government nor the Canadian forces announced the new agreement, which was signed on Valentine's Day in Texas. The U.S. military's NORTHCOM, however, publicized the agreement with a statement, outlining how its top officer, Jean Renault, and CanadaCOM's Dumais signed the plan, which allows the military from one nation to support the armed forces of the other. You can jump to NORTHCOM.mil and read their own press release, and it shows Renault and Dumais shaking hands and smiling. U.S. Northern Command, Canada Command establish new bilateral civil assistance plan. So they're basically now deciding to tell you that the militaries of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico are working together, all under the auspices of SPP and the NAU. If we jump across the pond yet again to the Times Online, 4,000 company directors are listed as global terror suspects and fraudsters. The names of almost 4,000 directors of British companies appear on international watch lists of alleged fraudsters, money launderers, terror financiers, and corrupt officials. A detailed study of the public register of directors held at Companies House uncovered people identified around the world as terrorist suspects, alleged drug traffickers, and individuals convicted ranging from illicit dealing in firearms to fraud. The research carried out by the Financial Intelligence Service World Check found 3,994 exact matches between its database of 750,000 high-risk individuals and the 6.8 million directors and businesses listed at Companies House. It also reported that it discovered 27,000 near matches in addition to their 3,994 exact matches. The research exposes an apparent absence of vetting who can and cannot register a business and become a company director in Britain. The Companies House website, which I have a link to, states that the only restrictions preventing anyone from becoming a director are being bankrupt or having been disqualified by the courts. So as if you needed more proof, the Fortune 500 companies and their overseas counterparts, of course, always leading the way in drugs, arms, and oil trafficking. You know, it's their god. Gold, oil, and drugs. So, like I said, I have a link over to World Check. Exposes terrorists, financial criminals, and disqualified directors in UK Companies House Register. So this came out from World Check, February 21st, Dateline, London. But let's jump to Pakistan now. Coming from the BBC, there's a whole rash of news, and even my own sort of personal experience with Pakistan versus YouTube.
What's up, y'all? It's the place where more than 100 million people come to see and share every kind of video, from the pointless to the political, from the silly to the deadly serious. Not everyone likes YouTube. The Pakistani authorities are angry about material they describe as anti-Islamic, including a trailer for a forthcoming film by a Dutch politician. But their attempts to block the site caused a global shutdown. Pakistan isn't the first country to decide that its citizens shouldn't be allowed access to this site. But the technique used to block YouTube in Pakistan ended up shutting out users all over the world. For nearly 2 hours, anyone trying to get to YouTube got nowhere. Here's why. Pakistani telecoms engineers issued what was in effect a dodgy roadmap, sending YouTube traffic down the wrong route. But this false trail leaked across the borders to a company sending internet traffic across Asia. And from there, it spread to internet providers around the world.
Pakistan Telecom forced its customers down a cul-de-sac by promising them a faster route to reach YouTube. Unfortunately, this promise leaked out to the rest of the internet, so other users ended up using the cul-de-sac.
Google, which owns YouTube, says it's still not clear whether the shutdown was a mistake or deliberate. But what it has shown is that governments which want to control or disrupt internet traffic can do that with some ease. Rory Kefton-Jones, BBC News.
So let's back up and go through this Pakistan versus YouTube story chronologically and jump to the first bit of it. Pakistan blocks YouTube website. Pakistan has blocked access to the popular YouTube website because of content deemed offensive to Islam. Its telecom authority ordered internet security providers to block the site until further notice. Reports said the content included those damn Danish cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad that have outraged many. But one report said a trailer for a forthcoming film by a Dutch lawmaker, Geert Wilders, which portrays Islam in a negative light, was behind the ban. They asked us to ban it immediately, and the order says the ban will continue until further notice, said the convener of the Association of Pakistan Internet Service Providers. Users are quite upset. They're screaming at ISPs, which can't do anything. The government has a valid reason for that, but they have to find a better way of doing it. If we continue blocking popular websites, people will stop using the internet. I don't know about that. Other countries that have temporarily blocked access to YouTube include Turkey and Thailand, and I think we've covered those on the show. So then, the follow-up to that is Pakistan lifts the ban on YouTube. The Pakistani Telecommunications Authority has told ISPs to restore access to YouTube. Google, the owner of YouTube, confirmed service had been restored in Pakistan. The attempt to block the site, reportedly because of a blasphemous video clip, caused a near global blackout of the site on Sunday. A spokesman for YouTube told BBC, "We're pleased to confirm that YouTube is again accessible in Pakistan." And then, jumping to Press TV, same report, Pakistan lifts ban on YouTube. That's just a different angle, that coming out of Iran. And then finally, once again from the BBC, and this is where the video slash audio you just heard comes from, details emerge on YouTube block. Pakistan has rejected claims that it was responsible for blocking global access to the YouTube video site. The interesting part is I was trying to upload videos to YouTube. It's going, God, what the hell is the problem? Why won't this load? And even went to my girlfriend's computer and tried to load it there, and it wouldn't come up. And she said, get out of my way. I'm doing my own thing. And then I found out that Pakistan was because I couldn't get on to YouTube. It was kind of bizarre to feel affected by bizarre international tensions in your little apartment in Portland, Oregon. Jumping now to a rash of news about that most favored nation of the United Nations, China, the model for the world totalitarian state. First from Press TV, China may end the one-child limit. I doubt it, but that's the headline. China, worried about an aging population, is considering how to waive the one-child policy while keeping family planning policies altogether. Zhao Beige, B-A-I-G-E, Vice Minister of the National Population and Family Planning Commission, told reporters on Thursday that government officials recognize that China must alter its current population control policies. We want incrementally to have this change. I cannot answer at what time or how, but this has become a big issue among decision makers. With the world's biggest population, 1.3 billion people, China has enforced rules to restrict family size since the 1970s. Rules vary, but usually limit families to one child or two in rural areas if the first child is an unfortunate girl. Experts have warned that China is steadily moving toward a demographic crisis with too many old people in need of expensive services and too few young workers paying taxes to meet those bills. The rules are privately detested by most Chinese and have been criticized abroad. The phrase one-child policy is commonly used in English to refer to the birth control policy or planned birth policy of the People's Republic of China. The Chinese government introduced the policy in 1979 to alleviate the overpopulation, social, and environmental problems of China. How's that working out for you? The policy is controversial both within and outside China because of the human rights issues it raises, because of the manner in which the policy has been implemented, and because of concerns about negative economic and social consequences. Under the Wikipedia heading Eugenic Policies, the one-child policy includes eugenic regulations. Both partners have to be rigorously tested before they marry. If one spouse has a quote-unquote unsatisfactory physical or mental condition, ranging from dyslexia to schizophrenia, they are banned to marry. However, the Chinese government claimed that the aims to, quote, improve the quality of the Chinese population. And again, we see that that's not working out so well. And I believe if you go down the whole of that, and I think it's documented in Alex Jones's Endgame, but I think something like an ambassador, either UN or to China, it was a guy named George Herbert Walker Bush that helped push China on their one-child policy. Staying on the China tip, this coming from the AP up on military.com, U.S. and China navies talk joint drills. The Chinese and U.S. navies may hold joint drills within the year as part of efforts to build stronger ties despite recent tensions and lingering mistrust. The exercises were discussed this week during a visit by Major General Thomas Conant, C-O-N-A-N-T, the U.S. Pacific Command's policy. China's official news agency reported February 27th, The two sides exchange views frankly and in depth on relevant issues concerning China-U.S. maritime military safety and discussed holding a joint maritime exercise between the two navies within the year. China's official news agency said the talks were held February 25th and 26th at a port city home to China's North Sea Fleet. That article goes on. I'm not going to get into it, but you can also jump to the report from China's official news agency, Xinhua. China-U.S. Navy officers meet on maritime military safety consultation mechanism. So we'll see if that happens. I have my severe doubts. But what's going to happen first is Beijing, China's 2008 Summer Pollution Olympics. So China in Olympics pollution drive, coming from the BBC, China has announced unprecedented measures to cut air pollution during this year's Olympic Games. Starting this weekend, new standards for car emissions will come into force in Beijing. Some areas surrounding the capital have also joined in efforts to help reduce air pollution. China has pledged Beijing's air quality will be up to the standard laid down by the World Health Organization during the Games in August. However, the air is still too dirty. One of the four indicators, the density of breathable particles in the air, is still too high. To cut pollution, a new standard for car emissions will be enforced from March 1st, falling in line with the latest EU standards. A new type of less polluting petrol will be available too. Cars and buses that fail the checks will be banned from the streets. And of course, with the Olympics, as we've noted before, it all ties in with them and their weather wars, trying to make the weather nice and pretty for the Olympics, and forcing British athletes to sign no criticism agreements, basically saying they won't criticize the corrupt totalitarian regime of China. But lastly, in our China news, we mentioned, I believe, that Steven Spielberg quit as a director of, you know, some of the spectacles with the Olympics. So he quit because of Darfur. And a new guy stepped into his spot, and now a new guy, Daryl Goodrich, he's having some second thoughts too. UK director's Olympic role unease. Steven Spielberg's resignation from the Beijing Olympics because of China's policy in Sudan has put pressure on others associated with the event. British director Daryl Goodrich, and I have a link to his website, which I think is actually under construction, who has just made a promotional film for the Olympics, admits he now questions his involvement in the Games. Spielberg resigned as an artistic director to the Games earlier this month. He said China was not doing enough to resolve the Darfur crisis. China, which says it's doing all it can to prevent murder and rape in Darfur, is trying to limit the damage caused by Mr. Spielberg's withdrawal. Mr. Goodrich made the promotional film that helped London win the 2012 Olympic Games. He was also invited along with four others to make a promotional film for Beijing, and now he's uncomfortable with his role. We need to think about exactly what's happened over the last couple days. His producer said he's now in a, quote, difficult position. Should have thought of that, buddy. Shifting gears back to the home front, back to the disease vaccine industry. This coming from the AP, childhood vaccine linked to convulsions. ProQuad vaccine linked to more convulsions. CDC panel amends preference for combo. Children suffered higher rates of fever-related convulsions when they got a Merck combo vaccine instead of two separate shots. The results prompted a federal advisory panel on vaccines to water down their preference for the combo vaccine ProQuad, which protects against measles, mumps, rubella, as well as chickenpox. In the study of children aged 12 months to 23 months, the rate of seizures was twice as high in toddlers who got ProQuad compared with those who got one shot for chickenpox and one for the measles, mumps, rubella. The risk translates to about one extra case of convulsion for every 2,000 doses of ProQuad. And so we'll see how Merck breaks down their cost-benefit analysis to see if it would cost more money to, you know, pay off all kinds of civil lawsuits or pull the product. Staying on the FDA, CDC, disease creation, disease industry tip, again coming from guardian.co.uk, Prozac, used by 40 million people, does not work. Analysis of unseen trials and other data concludes it is no better than placebo. Now, this Guardian report uses a full report that I have linked to. It is a massive one. It's published by the Public Library of Science, PLOS. But jumping to the article written by Sarah Bosley, Prozac, the best-selling antidepressant taken by 40 million people worldwide, does not work, and nor do similar drugs in the same class, according to a major review released. The study examined all available data on the drugs, including results from clinical trials that the manufacturers chose not to publish at the time. The trials compared the effect on patients taking the drugs with those given a placebo or sugar pill. When all the data was pulled together, it appeared that patients had improved, but those on placebo improved just as much as those on the drugs. The only exception is in the most severely depressed patients, according to the authors, Professor Irving Kirsch from the Department of Psychology at Hull University and colleagues in the U.S. and Canada. But that's probably because the placebo stopped working so well, they say, rather than the drugs having worked better. Given these results, there seems little reason to prescribe antidepressant medication to any but the most severely depressed patients. Like I said, you can read that entire massive report with tons of footnotes. And think about that. However, of course, doctors were quick to say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, don't stop taking antidepressants." This is coming from the AFP. Doctors urged patients to keep taking their antidepressants Wednesday despite a scientific study showing that the drugs are a little more effective than placebos. Doctors are warning their patients not to suddenly stop taking the medication prescribed to them. Patients suffering from depression are expected to raise questions about the effectiveness of their treatment plan following controversial claims by researchers who said that selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs like Prozac are barely more effective than sugar pills. Barely more effective. And you gotta wonder, when you're watching, or you see those commercials on television, they tell you that if you take the sleeping pill, side effects may include compulsive gambling and promiscuous behavior. And as we've mentioned, the lone nutter shooting cases, or whenever a mom drowns her kids, or any of those things, they're on psychotropic drugs. Jumping to my home state of West Virginia, Dateline Clarksburg, judge upholds $196.2 million award against DuPont. A circuit court judge has upheld a $196 million punitive damage award against DuPont in a class action pollution case. Harrison County Circuit Court Chief Judge Thomas A. Bedell, B-E-D-E-L-L, also adopted a nearly $130 million estimate for a medical monitoring plan, but ordered the Wilmington, Delaware-based chemical giant to pay for those costs as they occur. The jury in the case required DuPont to provide medical monitoring for 40 years to people who were exposed to arsenic, cadmium, and lead from a former zinc smelting plant in the small community of Spelter. DuPont said in a statement Tuesday that it was disappointed by the ruling and plans to appeal to the West Virginia Supreme Court. "We believe there were numerous errors, blah, blah, blah. I put a lot of links in there, and you can, there's even YouTube videos from people involved in the lawsuit. I always remember when we would drive into the Charleston and Clarksburg area where all these DuPont and chemical plants were. It was nasty. And even as a little kid, I couldn't imagine living there. And now we see the massive things that come from it. Even just a couple weeks ago, we covered, of course, the mysterious blue haze in Point Pleasant that, of course, was coming from the pollution and chemical plants. Returning to the Svalbard Seed Vault, otherwise known as the Doomsday Vault. The Doomsday Vault has opened now in a bid to preserve seeds. So the first article we're going to hit up, coming from theherald.co.uk. When the Doomsday Vault opens in the freezing Arctic archipelago of Svalbard this week, it will mark the latest attempt to preserve our national resources, or rather our natural resources, in the face of climate change and other threats the planet faces. It builds on work by seed banks around the world that aim to conserve the agricultural and wild plant species on which life on Earth depends. Kerry Fowler, the man behind the Doomsday Vault, said the backup crop seed bank had been constructed in the context of 9/11 and Katrina, and in recognition that contingency plans had to be made against natural or man-made disasters. After those events, he said, there was a lot of recrimination, a sense of the inevitability of catastrophe, and everybody was pointing the finger and asking, why didn't somebody do anything? Experts who work in the field of seed preservation, Monsanto, and crop biodiversity, or rather crop diversity, know seed banks are losing stories through everyday problems and occasionally through natural disasters or civil strife. With that knowledge, a failure to plan for such events would raise the question of whether they were any different from those who should have been planning for Hurricane Katrina, and which I would add, 9/11.
We have been digging in the mountains and the earth for many years to find coal. Now we have the possibility to provide a safe storage for a worldwide responsibility to preserve the seed, different kinds of seeds, all over the world, except to these mountains.
Well, the conditions down here in the vault are perfect. Where the international standard is that we store them at about minus 18, minus 20, we have that. And perfectly safe and secure. And, of course, it's pretty cold in Svalbard around here. So we have just the best insulated freezer in the world, probably. In the past, when accidents or natural disasters or war intervened and destroyed samples, then that was it. They were as dead as a dinosaur, extinct. But we're going to put an end to extinction with this vault because we're going to have a safety backup and plan B.
So everything's going to be great. Nothing could possibly go... Wait. Oh, shit. Norway's biggest earthquake ever in Arctic Archipelago. February 21st, from the AFP, Norway's biggest ever earthquake, measuring 6.2 on the Richter scale, shook the Arctic archipelago of Svalbard early Thursday, a Norwegian seismology institute said. No one was injured and no damage was reported after the earthquake struck about 87 miles southeast of Longyearbyen, the main town in the archipelago that is home to some 2,300 people. Longyearbyen, one of the world's most northerly towns, is home to a new doomsday vault of samples of the most important seeds on Earth aimed at providing mankind with a reserve in the event of a global catastrophe. The vault, set to be inaugurated next Tuesday by European Commission President José Manuel Barroso, Nobel Peace Prize winning environmentalist Wangari Maathai, and Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. So there you go. They're opening the foolproof Doomsday Seed Vault. And then the biggest quake ever hit. So you better think about Plan C. Jumping yet again to the BBC, staying on the science enviro tip. First look at Vast Book of Life. The first 30,000 pages have been unveiled of a vast encyclopedia which aims to catalog every one of our planet's 1.8 million species. The immense online research is designed to greatly enhance our understanding of the world's diminishing biodiversity. The creators of the database say it could have an impact on human knowledge comparable to that which followed the microscope's invention in the 1600s. It's designed to be used by everyone from scientists to lay readers. The Encyclopedia of Life, EOL.org, described as the ultimate field guide, is to encompass all six kingdoms of life and even viruses, which many researchers do not consider to be living organisms. So you can go to EOL, Encyclopedia of Life, EOL.org, and check out the new wiki animal kingdom. Jumping to clicktohouston.com, and once again, the UN, with their great ideas, they're promoting eating insects. Crickets, caterpillars, and grubs are high in protein and minerals and could be an important food source during droughts and other emergencies. I definitely think they can assist, said German biologist V.B. Meyer-Rockhol, who regularly eats insects himself and wore a t-shirt with a harlequin longhorn beetle to a UN-sponsored conference this month on promoting bugs as a food source. 36 scientists from 15 countries gathered in the northern Thailand city, home to several dozen restaurants serving insects and other bugs. Some of their proposals were more down-to-earth than others. A Japanese scientist proposed bug farms on spacecraft to feed astronauts, noting that it would be more practical than raising cows or pigs. Australian, Dutch, and American researchers said more restaurants are serving the critters in their countries. the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, and I link you to their press release about this conference, estimates 1,400 species of insects and worms are eaten in almost 90 countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Researchers at the conference detail how crickets and silkworms are eaten in Thailand, grubs and grasshoppers in Africa, and ants in South America. So, basically, just wait till they want to promote the idea for you and I to eat bugs in the rapidly third-worlding USA. Getting back to a little more weather wars, there was a report from KVII-TV. I stole a video, and I uploaded it to YouTube, and it's the cloud seeding controversy.
I've heard of cloud seeding. It is a controversial process that tries to maximize moisture in the clouds, kind of a high-tech rain dance, if you will. Well, tonight there was a public meeting for the renewal of Groundwater Conservation District's permit for cloud seeding. Our Laura Rice was the only TV reporter there, and she found out that on this issue, when it rains, it pours.
About 50 Panhandle ranchers and farmers waited 4 years to speak out once again about cloud seeding in the PGCD.
We're people that are, we're farmers and ranchers and look to the heavens, you know, on a regular basis for the rainfall.
Many fought the same battle 2 years ago when the North Plains Groundwater District decided to end their program.
Now we're having to deal with it again. We really feel like that it's detrimental to our area.
Here's one complaint. Planes shoot flares of silver iodide into clouds in both the target area and the buffer zone, with only the goal of making it rain in the target area. Those in the buffer zone say their rain is being stolen.
If the good Lord above decides I don't need a rain, I can handle it. But, you know, when it gets down to a man deciding who gets it and what amount and who doesn't, it's just plain old not right.
But the groundwater district sees it another way.
It's kind of like putting fertilizer on a crop. You put it on and hope that it increases the yield. So that's all we're trying to do is increase the yield.
Many land workers also say they just don't think it's natural.
You get used to knowing what things all take place. And when things quit happening like they have for most of your life, you begin to ask questions, why?
These farmers and ranchers just aren't happy with the PGCD, especially after they admittedly seeded clouds in Briscoe County without a permit last year.
I'm human and make mistakes just like everybody else.
Still, as far as some are concerned, it's their livelihood, and they'd appreciate it if you wouldn't tinker with it. Laura Rice, Pro News 7.
The Department of Licensing and Regulation in Austin will examine all that happened in tonight's meeting. Then, the executive director will make a decision on whether or not to approve the cloud seeding permit by March 13th.
And you can go down the rabbit hole of weather wars and cloud seeding and HAARP and all that if you hit up some of the links in that cloud seeding post on MediaMonarchy.com. Inching into hour two of episode 65 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you leap day, February 29th, 2008. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and RevereRadioNetwork.com. And you can, of course, hit me up, MySpace, Dig, and YouTube, and Yahoo, and iTunes, and Radio for All.net, and Archive.org. We're going to jump now into a whole swath of news about the growing technology, future combat system, police state, robot war insanity. Our first story coming from the AFP, automated killer robots, threat to humanity. Increasingly autonomous, gun-toting robots developed for warfare could easily fall into the hands of terrorists and may one day unleash a robot arms race. They pose a threat to humanity, said University of Sheffield professor Noel Sharkey ahead of a keynote address Wednesday before Britain's Royal United Services Institute. And as a sidebar mention, Noel Sharkey went on the Alex Jones Show yesterday on the 28th, so there's a long interview with him that you can hit up. Didn't have time to grab it today or the space in the show. Back to the article. Intelligent machines deployed on battlefields around the world, from mobile grenade launchers to rocket-firing drones, can already identify and lock onto targets without human help. There are more than 4,000 U.S. military robots on the ground in Iraq, as well as unmanned aerial aircraft that have clocked hundreds of thousands of flight hours. The first three armed combat robots fitted with large-caliber machine guns deployed to Iraq last summer, manufactured by U.S. arms maker Foster Miller. They proved so successful that 80 more are on order. But up to now, a human hand is always required to push the button or pull the trigger. If we're not careful, Noel Sharkey said, that could change. Military leaders are quite clear they want autonomous robots as soon as possible because they are more cost-effective and give a risk-free war. Several countries, led by the U.S., have already invested heavily in robot warriors developed for use on the battlefield. South Korea and Israel both deploy armed robot border guards, while China, India, Russia, and Britain have all increased the use of military robots. Washington plans to spend $4 billion by 2010 on unmanned technology systems, with total spending expected to rise to $24 billion, according to the DoD's Unmanned Systems Roadmap, released in December. Jesse Canton, an expert on technology innovation and CEO of the Institute for Global Futures, predicts that deployment within a decade of detachments that will include 150 soldiers and 2,000 robots. The use of such devices by terrorists should be a serious concern, said Noel Sharkey. And the article goes on, and I'll just tell you, the interview, of course, mentions that these robots will give a detached other person, someone who spent the previous 10 years playing Counter-Strike and Worlds of Warcraft for 12 hours a day and shooting things. They're going to sit in a desert at some military base and blast people and feel no pain. Moving to Washington technology, you've heard mention on this show before of SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and you should look more into them and their dirty work. SAIC gets urban warfare research work. SAIC will assist the Army in developing technology that will allow troops to see inside buildings during urban military operations under a $5.2 million contract. Under the contract, SAIC will help the Army develop and test technology for the concept known as VisiBuilding, V-I-S-I building. VisiBuilding is a project by the Strategic Technology Office in DARPA. In urban warfare, warfighters no longer have the advantages of traditional surveillance and reconnaissance methods after enemy forces retreat indoors. The goal is to find ways to help troops determine building layouts, find unusual quantities of materials inside structures, and locate people in buildings. To accomplish this requires using signal, sensor, and modeling technologies, according to DARPA. SAIC will perform the work in San Diego, where the company is based, and should have the work completed by August 15, 2009. The Army received 70 bids for the work, the DoD said, and the contracting authority is the Communications and Electronics Command Acquisition Center at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, and SAIC ranks number 5 on WashingtonTechnology.com's top 100 list of the largest federal government prime contractors. Now, I believe last summer on Portland, Oregon's own Top-Off Drills, I believe we had some SAIC involvement, so shifting into some drills, and again from click2houston.com, billboard depicts fire cloud over Houston. A billboard went up along the Southwest Freeway depicting the Bayou City as a terrorist target. It's a bright orange fire cloud over Houston, and it's a campaign billboard for Brian Klock, K-L-O-C-K, a Republican candidate for U.S. Representative District 22. I don't want people to be scared. I don't want anyone upset. I want people to be aware. He spent $10,000 on the scary-looking billboard with Houston through the sight of a gun with a big red cloud of some sort. And that, of course, reminds us of other billboards that have gone up saying, be prepared, and they have strange cryptic dates written on them and newspaper headlines. But if we jump yet again to globalresearch.ca, there's an article from Captain Eric May. It's called False Flag Prospects 2008, Top 3 U.S. Target Cities. Now again, speaking of Top All 4 and Noble Resolve that were going on in Portland in the last few months. And of course, we have more drills coming our way in the coming year here in Portland. Eric May did a lot of work on exposing these drills and appeared on Press Watch on KBOO here in Portland. A lot of articles, a lot of interviews, did interviews with Alex Ansari and many, many, many people. So his new article, globalresearch.ca, False Flag Prospects 2008 Top 3 U.S. Cities, basically talks about how whenever there's an attack, as we've mentioned on the show many, many times, there's always a drill going on. 9/11, 7/7. Hell, even the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan had Operation Nine Lives about presidential succession. So there's always a drill. So in this article, as he recounts some of the latest drills and threat mongering from Chertoff and the like, jumping down to top three U.S. target cities. Last year, I published, I being Captain Eric May, Next 9/11 Summer 2007? ? In response to the same kind of questions that have led me to publish this essay is a 2008 update. My 2007 three most likely cities for the next 9/11 were Houston, Chicago, and Portland. This year, the same three cities are still most endangered in light of the fact that U.S. military has designated Texas, Indiana, and Oregon as three of its four target states in the 2008 version of its Noble Resolve military exercises. Granted, Chicago is in Illinois, not Indiana, but Indiana is quite close and has been used to stage forces for terror exercises conducted in Chicago in recent years. It may come as a surprise to people not acquainted with military preparations that the same cities remain on the list, even though analysts like me have publicized them widely. So let's jump to the top three cities. Primary target, Houston, where Brian Klock just put out his billboard showing the city blowing up. Over the past 4 years, military and police veterans like me have been alerting the public to government exercises aiming at the nuclear destruction of Houston's Petro suburbs. Five times in those 4 years, we were able to predict within a day of a major petrochemical explosion in those Petro suburbs. The odds against this kind of accuracy are astronomical. At the center of big oil in the Bush family, Houston remains the most endangered city in America. Secondary target, Chicago. While Houston is the most endangered city, the most endangered building, the best candidate to be the next World Trade Center is the Sears Tower, of course, also owned by Larry Silverstein. And third, the tertiary target, Portland, Oregon. Called Little Beirut by Bush cronies because of its enmity to Bush 41 and 43, only made my top three list last summer when it was designated as a target for a nuclear attack by successive exercises Noble Resolve and Top Off. The language in an official press release stated the case plainly enough. Noble Resolve will coordinate with officials in Oregon to model a nuclear attack on Portland. In the course of researching Portland for a series of articles I wrote about the city and its exercises, I discovered that Stanford and Harvard had prepared a detailed nuclear fallout map for it, that national military commanders and state National Guard commanders were telling different stories about what the exercises were trying to accomplish, and that the Portland's Oregonian newspaper was doing everything it could to avoid investigating the frightening anomalies. I wasn't all that surprised when the last day of the exercises found Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff in downtown Portland, which was largely closed down by an unexpected bomb threat. And as I mentioned, when that was going on last summer, that unexpected bomb threat at the Lloyd Center in Northeast Portland is literally fucking 5 or 6 blocks away from me. Jumping to more crazy police state weaponry, the San Jose Police Department now have new LRADs. That's long-range acoustic device. That's, of course, the sound wave cannon, the brown noise, the... I don't know what you want to call it. But it'll basically ruin your ears and make you shit your pants, if you're lucky. San Jose police have a new crime-fighting tool. You might want to hear about it, but you won't want to hear it being used. They'll be using a disc-shaped sonic weapon called long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, mostly used as a high-grade sound weapon to amplify police officers' orders at a great distance. But it can also be used as another of the department's less lethal weapons. The ear-splitting device is growing in popularity around the globe and has been used by soldiers to flush suspected terrorists out of caves in Afghanistan. If we now jump to the Daily Mail... dailymail.co.uk, roadside cameras that detect blood will catch lone drivers who abuse car-sharing lanes. That's kind of a mouthful of a UK headline. Motorists will be targeted by a new generation of road cameras which work out how many people are in a car by measuring the amount of bodily fluid it contains. This latest snooping device on the nation's roads aims to penalize lone drivers who abuse car-sharing lanes, the carpool lane, the HOV lane, and is part of a government effort to combat congestion at busy times. The cameras work by sending an infrared beam through the windscreen of vehicles
which detects the unique makeup of blood and water content in human skin. The system's inventors believe it will catch out motorists who try to fool existing CCTV road cameras by placing mannequins in passenger seats or fixing photographs to windscreens. It will be first used by police car sharing lanes in Leeds, but of course councils across the country have already expressed interest in surveilling their rapidly less free populace. Jumping now, I believe it's for the first time this week, that's a record, to Danger Room on Wire.com. Nuke standards slipping. Last year, a B-52 mistakenly loaded with nuclear weapons took a trip across the U.S., sparking concerns about the safety of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The important question, however, is whether this incident was an isolated snafu or indicative of deeper problems in the nuclear world. Some are arguing it is indeed the latter. Safety standards and procedures in the nuclear world have been eroding for years, reports Air Force Times, the same newspaper that broke the original Bent Spear incident. So, reading from Air Force Times, four Air Force generals who testified about the Minot incident and nuclear security before the Senate Armed Services Committee on February 12th said the service has lost its focus on the nuclear mission. And there's a report and a big long PDF from the Defense Science Board, and of course, lots of links about the supposed accidental lone loose flying nukes in Minot and Barksdale and all that. If we jump to thinkprogress.org, torture advocate William Haynes resigns. Now, I'm not sure if we mentioned William Haynes by name, but we, of course, recently mentioned the project he was involved in, and that are those rigged military tribunal trials coming up for the six masterminds of 9/11. Defense Department General Counsel William Haynes, who was a, quote, prime mover in the Bush administration's efforts to bypass the Geneva Convention, announced that he is returning to private life next month. Already a controversial figure due to his torture advocacy, the negative spotlight on Haynes increased last week when former Gitmo prosecutor Colonel Morris David told the Nation that Haynes had insisted that the administration, quote, can't have acquittals, end quote, at Guantanamo Bay. And there's more on Haynes and his role in the Bush administration, and you can take that down the rabbit hole. So basically, the guy that was involved in this big show trial coming up, for whatever reason, has bailed and is returning to private life. Maybe he was birdcage liner and he was too saturated with shit and they had to pull him out of there. Or maybe he suddenly had some sort of crisis of conscience and decided to quit. A quick obituary. Skull and Bones Buckley, dead at 82. So if we read from Winter Patriot, straight to hell, William F. Buckley is dead. The evil sons of bitches have lost one of their leaders. William F. Buckley is dead at 82. So if we jump to theguardian.co.uk, William Buckley, the U.S. conservative columnist once described as the scourge of liberalism, has died at the age of 82. Buckley was found at the desk of his study at his home in Stamford, Connecticut. He might have been working on a column, his son, Christopher Buckley, told the New York Times. In a career that included a short stint in the CIA, I don't know if anyone has a short stint in the CIA, Buckley, a patrician figure, proved himself a prolific man of letters. He wrote more than 45 books, from works on sailing to spy novels, penned 5,600 biweekly columns, and founded the influential conservative magazine National Review, as well as hosting a long-running TV chat show, Firing Line. Now, of course, in the wake of his death, there's a clip from Firing Line with Buckley battling it out with Noam Chomsky. That's pretty interesting, and of course, after his death, it raced up the top 100 list. But if we read a little bit about William F. Buckley Jr., born November 24th, 2005. He came on the public scene with an essay called God and Man at Yale. And he's the author, like I mentioned, of over 50 books and yada yada. He was in the CIA. He went to Yale. He is a Skull and Bonesman. Buckley attended the National Autonomous University of Mexico in 1943 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army the following year. In his book, Miles Gone By, he briefly recounts being a member of Franklin Roosevelt's honor guard when the president died. With the end of World War II in 1945, he enrolled in Yale University, where he became a member of the secret Skull and Bone Society. Was a debater, an active member in the Conservative Party and of the Yale Political Union, and served as the editor-in-chief of the Yale Daily News. In 1951, Buckley was recruited into the Central Intelligence Agency, yet served for less than a year. Little has been published regarding Buckley's work within the CIA, but in a 2001 letter to author W. Thomas Smith Jr., Buckley wrote, quote, "I did training in Washington as a secret agent and was sent to Mexico City. There I served under the direct supervision of Howard Hunt, about whom, of course, a great deal is known," end quote. So that's William F. Buckley admitting Skull and Bones, Yale, CIA, Howard Hunt. And as we mentioned, he was an author. One of his most famous characters is called Blackford Oakes. Now, of course, Howard Hunt wrote lots of spy novels, too, with supposed fictional spy stories. Blackford Oakes, a fictional character, a CIA agent, and the protagonist of a series of novels written by William F. Buckley Jr. Let's see how different this is from William F. Buckley. Served in World War II as a pilot and graduated from Yale. He joined the CIA in 51 after being recruited by his closest boyhood friend, Anthony Trust, Tony Trust, also a young CIA agent. And it gets into silly personal domestic affairs. But there you go. William F. Buckley, CIA agent, Skull and Bonesman, dead at 82. Thank God there are people and organizations like the Billboard Liberation Front. So if we jump yet again to threat level, improved Billboard touts AT&T and NSA collaboration. The Billboard Liberation Front has struck again, this time rewriting a billboard in San Francisco's Mission District that was hosting AT&T's latest ad campaign touting the breadth of its network coverage. So it basically said AT&T works in more places like Chai London, Moscow, which is a play on its new ad campaign that says it'll reach everywhere like Chicago, London, Moscow, and they smash the word together. However, when you look at the big billboard and the remixing, culture-jamming, monkey-wrenching ad-busting that the Billboard Liberation Front has done, it now says, nice and beautifully done, AT&T works in more places like NSA headquarters. So you gotta hit up that post to check out that photo. It's nice, big, and beautiful. Jumping now to my man, Alex Ansary, alexansary.com. He is the mad prophet of the Portland airwaves. He does a show outside the box every week on Portland Community Media TV. His latest episode of the TV show is Outside the Box number 140. He, of course, also has his weekly radio show on We the People Radio Network, and all those links and downloads are there for you in the posting Outside the Box 140. I'm going to play a clip for you because I think it's been a couple weeks since I've played anything from Alex Ansary, and this clip is a doozy. He gets fired up, as you should be.
When you add everything up, man, you stand up on the hillside and you see your community, you see your town, and you realize there is a totally different reality taking place than the reality your neighbors are aware of. And what makes me burn with rage is knowing how asleep my neighbors are in multiple neighborhoods and cities across America and cities across the globe. That when this shit hits the fan, they will turn the guns on themselves instead of realizing and connecting the dots that all of this was planned for years to push you into the combat cities, to control the seed, to control energy, to propose a global carbon tax, to maintain the 800 FEMA camps, which are in our country today, and turn schools into FEMA camps. What the hell do you think Top Off 4 was about in Portland, Oregon? What the hell do you think Noble Resolve was about? And it's coming back. They have more drills coming to the Oregon area. More drills with the full support of Kulongoski and Mayor Tom Potter, which will soon be stepping down. The question is, Sam Adams, the popular candidate, what does he have to say about all this mess? What does he have to say about the new military technology being used in our own cities? The Tuesday before last, I got a phone call from one of my coworkers telling me that in downtown Portland, there was some major, major, hardcore police activity taking place in downtown. Checkpoints. Do you have your tags, your papers all in order? You know, you might have seen my surveillance in Portland, Oregon YouTube video that I taped in August. 2005. From what I heard, this was much more expansive than that, pulling people over with anything wrong, including harassing people that were just walking by on the street, all in the region around Brumadies Pan, around 3rd and Burnside. And so when you look at all of these different things, and I ask myself, why didn't any of you email me this? Why aren't there people on the street emailing me and telling me about this? Instead, I get a text on my cell phone from a coworker. That's all I got. There's nothing in the news. There's nothing on indie media. This city is a slate. It's nothing. It's a slate. The progressive fallacy is nothing but a goddamn lie. We should be mobilized into groups, working together, talking about gardening, talking about how we're going to take care of one another. When there is no government, there is no police. And in every crisis situation, God damn it, you better realize the commodities that are being traded is the flesh of women. You better goddamn wake up and realize that women are shipped back and forth all over the Middle East and Asia as sex toys, usually 13, 12. We've read you reports about in the Congo how the UN peacekeepers were involved in screwing little girls for as little as a dollar a day, and in some cases, feeding them nothing more than eggs for a good fuck. Now, you want to take a look at this, or do you not want to take a look at this? Is this upsetting you, or is it not upsetting you? Are you connected, or are you disconnected from reality? You've got to give in to your strength. You've got to find that place. You've got to find that place in your own cell, in your body, that recognizes the fact that we have been under control for so long. You've got to realize that we're herd animals to a certain degree, and we have to break out of that. Free our mind, and our ass will follow. You've got to have a little bit of faith. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. No countries to migrate to, and I'm sick and goddamn tired of people talking about this bullshit about going here, going to that place, doing this, doing that. You're not going anywhere. They've got more data on everybody that's leaving the country. New passport regulations for you to leave the country. All this data being amassed on you in these databases. Those people leaving the country, exiting the country. The real ID being required for you to enter a federal building. Being required possibly in the future for you to work. The Real ID Act of 2008 being required for you to travel on an airplane. This is the police state, and goddammit, you're living in it. And this is more high-tech than anything that could have been written 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. It's beyond 1984. Things transpiring today make 1984 look passé. You've got to wake up, and you've got to wake up fast. We got a clip from our friend Mo, who calls in every week, from the film Right at Your Door. More predictive programming, just like CBS's Jericho, where they have in their new plot for their new season, which I believe aired just a couple days ago, or will air in just a couple days, a scenario where martial law is declared on our own soil after a false flag terrorist attack. It's in the movies. It's in the movies. It's here. It's there. You can't run from it. You can't hide from it. From Children of Men, from this to that, to the radio, to the print, to the Oregonian. No solutions, no answers, no glimpse of how we can transcend this reality. Just fear. Because when you're locked into that five-sense reality of fear, your immune system literally breaks down. You're trapped in the third-dimensional five-sense reality when you're obsessed with fear. When you're obsessed with nothing more than survival. Now, we're going to talk about the importance of survival again in just a little bit, but you have to balance it with your own spirituality and fearlessness of the future, no matter what happens. You see, as things get worse, more light bulbs turn on in the minds of millions and billions around the globe. And there is an enlightenment process that takes place in each one of us on the individual level. But with movies like this, people see this and they believe this is an inevitable reality. And they accept the big white black lie that all our security from the malls, from downtown, the private security forces that are being hired domestically, outside traditional domestic law enforcement, the whole world of mercenary law enforcement, and that also includes those being employed by the Portland Business Alliance, doing their sweeps on our own streets in downtown Portland. It brings tears to my eyes to start to read about how many people are out there watching you, manning what they think is going to be the next target. and top off for their drill, predicting how Homeland Security would gallop to the rescue in the case of an RDD attack in our own goddamn city. There's no talk about water. There's no talk about food. There's no talk about shelter. It's how do we turn over control to the new commanders-in-chief.
That's a wicked, righteous rant from a man, Alex Ansary, from episode 140 of Outside the Box. My name's James, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority. It's episode 65 of MediaMonarchy.com. Now I believe it's time. I've been quite neglectful in the last couple weeks. The story that I'm about to read came out February 9th. And I just haven't covered it on the show. I didn't have time. I didn't get it posted, yada, yada, yada. But I'm going to do it now. Alex just mentioned it in that rant. It's called InfraGard. InfraGard. So coming from Press TV, and of course from an article that originated from Matthew Rothschild in The Progressive, FBI spawns shoot to kill citizens. The FBI reportedly launches a clandestine alliance which prepares privileged citizens to shoot to kill without possibility of prosecution. An alliance dubbed the InfraGard, which reportedly consists of over 23,000 representatives of the U.S. private sector, in addition to the FBI and Homeland Security, is engaged in secret activities to maintain elements of critical national infrastructure. According to a February 7th article published in the Progressive magazine, these businessmen impart vital information to the FBI in return for secret intelligence about terrorist threats prior to informing the public and perhaps even other government officials. One business owner in the U.S. tells me that InfraGard members are being advised on how to prepare for a martial law situation and what their role might be, author Matthew Rothschild quoted a whistleblower saying. Then they said when, not if, martial law is declared. It was our responsibility to protect our portion of the infrastructure, and if we have to use deadly force to protect it, we couldn't be prosecuted. The report added that a business executive who had an InfraGard card said the organization's activities have foreseen granting permission to shoot to kill. By infrastructure, he was referring to such sectors as agriculture, defense, energy, food, information, telecommunications, law enforcement, public health, transportation, the banking and finance sectors, as well as the chemical industry in which InfraGard members are believed to be the most active. Business leaders have basically been deputized by Homeland Security to shoot to kill when martial law happens. How did we get to all this? We got to it from the granddaddy of false flag terrorist attacks, and now I got a whole swath of 9/11 news for you. At the top of the heap, a massive report coming from not only Raw Story, but from a FOIA request and new documents posted to Paul Thompson's Terror Timeline, cooperativeresearch.org, alleged hijacker booked post 9/11 flights. Astounding, newly released FBI documents obtained via the Freedom of Information Act show that alleged 9/11 hijacker Hamza Al-Ghamdi had booked future flights to San Francisco and Riyadh, suggesting that he was unaware of his eventful fate, or rather eventual fate, aboard United Airlines Flight 175, the plane that hit the World Trade Center's South Tower. The papers consist of a 300-page FBI timeline, which you can download, the full PDF, that was used by the 9/11 Commission but not made public until now. The 9/11 Commission failed to mention in its final report that Al-Ghamdi was booked onto several flights scheduled to take place after 9/11, including another flight on the very day of the attacks. The fact that Al-Ghamdi had booked post-9/11 flights obviously gives rise to doubts about whether the alleged hijacker knew the 9/11 attack was a suicide mission, and even brings into question if he was on the flight at all. Citing United Airlines passenger information on page 288 under an entry pertaining to H. Al-Ghamdi, the FBI timeline reads, future flight scheduled to depart L.A. International Airport for San Francisco. Al-Ghamdi was also booked to fly on September 20th from Casablanca, Morocco to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and September 29th when he planned to fly from Riyadh to Dammam, Saudi Arabia. The FBI timeline documents also contradict with several other details the 9/11 Commission report, notably on the movements of alleged Flight 77 hijackers Nawaf al-Hamzi and Khalid al-Midar. According to researcher Paul Thompson, he believes the commission cherry-picked the dates of the alleged hijackers' movements in order to shield their ties with high-level Saudi Arabian officials. If we now jump to, lastly I'll mention former 20-year veteran CIA case officer Robert Baer, who has previously asserted that 9/11 has all the aspects of being an inside job, told Raw Story that the new developments immediately demand the 9/11 investigation be reopened. There are enough discrepancies and unanswered questions in the 9/11 Commission report that under a friendly administration, the 9/11 investigation should be opened. Friendly administration, I guess, being the operative phrase there. So there's two different long articles on Raw Story. FBI documents contradict 9/11 Commission report, part one and part two. Hijacker had post 9/11 flights. And also page two. And this is, of course, put together by Larissa Alexandrovna at Raw Story. Link to Newsweek and Paul Thompson's timeline. And, of course, you can download the redacted hijackers timeline. If we jump to cooperative research, let's hit a little entry that has al-Ghamdi in its tags related to the story. September 15th through the 17th, 2001. Did some hijackers get U.S. military training? A series of articles suggest that at least six of the 9/11 hijackers trained at U.S. military bases. Sources? New York Times, Newsweek, Washington Post. Three of the alleged hijackers, Ahmed al-Nami, Ahmed al-Ghamdi, and Saeed al-Ghamdi, are revealed as having listed the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, as their permanent address on their driver's license and car registrations. According to military records, the three use 10 Radford Boulevard as their address. This is a base roadway where residences for foreign military flight trainees are located. Hamza al-Ghamdi was also connected to the Pensacola base. Source, Newsweek, Washington Post, Pensacola News Journal. And that goes on, cited from the Post and Newsweek and Gannett and LA Times and many, many, many more. So, the alleged hijackers, of course, trained at U.S. military bases. We now have evidence that one of the hijackers had other flights booked after his fateful 175 crash into the South Tower. So now we jump to ABC News. February 27th, 9/11 redux. Thousands of aliens in U.S. flight schools illegally. Thousands of foreign student pilots have been able to enroll and obtain pilot license from U.S. flight schools despite tough laws passed in the wake of 9/11. Some of the very same conditions that allowed the 9/11 tragedy to happen in the first place are still very much in existence today, wrote one regional security officer to his boss at the TSA. And those memos have been released, and you can download that PDF of the TSA inter-office memorandum. If you hit up the ABC News story, they have a little video. But let's jump now to the Corbett Report. Lone gunman producer questions government on 9/11. Wonders why TV writers could accurately predict the attack while the government couldn't. So I've got a clip for you, but I'm going to set this up in case you're unaware. Cast and crew of The X-Files attended WonderCon 2008 in San Diego last weekend to discuss the upcoming X-Files movie. During the question and answer, one intrepid audience member asked Chris Carter, creator of X-Files and The Lone Gunman, about the pilot episode of The Lone Gunman, which eerily predicted the events of 9/11 that took place in New York mere months after the episode aired on TV. Carter, looking slightly flustered, turned the question over to his Lone Gunman producer, Frank Spotnitz.
I'm going to give it to my colleague here, Frank Spotnitz, who actually had more to do with the Lone Gunman than I did. And Lone Gunman were created, if you remember in the episode, first season episode, by Glenn Morgan and James Wong, and then we did the TV series. Frank really had so much more to do with it, and especially that part of the storyline, I think he has a special underground connection.
No, actually, no connection at all. But yes, Mark Snow is doing the score for the movie. But we're just looking for the most awful crime you can imagine, and as simple as that. And I think all of us, I He'd say that our first thought that morning of September 11th was a lone gunman. And I was stricken with the thought that maybe we, you know, had somehow inspired it in some way. And I was greatly relieved to learn the plot that existed long before that was on television. And then disturbed that if we could imagine it, our government didn't. And I didn't understand why we weren't prepared for a tragedy like that. But, it's been the subject of some conspiracy theories online. And, you know, we were directed to write it and so on. And it's just an act of imagination.
After Carter's bizarre and awkward joke about turning the question over to his producer because he had a special underground connection that made him better qualified to answer it, Spotnitz admits he was disturbed that if we could imagine it, our government didn't, and I didn't understand why we weren't prepared for a tragedy like that. After raising this very valid point about the government and military's complete lack of response on the morning of 9/11, he then quickly dismisses any suggestion that the pilot episode's uncanny prediction of that attack was anything more than a coincidence, as the story was produced merely from an active imagination. The episode in question featured rogue elements of the government hijacking a plane by remote control and attempting to fly it into the World Trade Center in order to launch wars in the Middle East. That was the pilot episode of the X-Files spinoff, The Lone Gunman. There's a lot of links in that story, so you can see how Frank Spotnitz was on the BBC's 9/11 Truth hit piece last year. So there's an interview with him on the Conspiracy File show. There's an article up on Prison Planet, but basically Spotnitz regurgitates some Fox News garbage that people who believe in conspiracy theories use it as a security blanket to comfort yourselves. And also linked up is an interview with Dean Haglund, star of The Lone Gunman, an interview with Alex Jones from a few years ago, where he basically says that after years of writing The X-Files, the FBI and NASA would approach Chris Carter with plots for stories. He also discussed the fact that the CIA have since the 80s hired informants posing as psychics to attend Hollywood parties and report back to the CIA on general trends and talking points. And you can watch that whole interview. So, finally, I believe, linked up in conjunction with all this, WonderCon. There's an article up about the WonderCon convention. WonderCon confronts the rise of the police state. The biggest cheers at WonderCon weren't for killer robots, but for allegories about government conspiracies, endless wars, and terrorism. Much of the weekend felt like a poli-sci seminar, except with nuclear holocausts and mutated alien bugs instead of textbooks. If you needed proof that the shadow of 9/11 keeps falling over our formerly escapist narratives, then you only need to sit in on any one of the con's jam-packed panels. And it goes into Chris Carter and conspiracy mania and X-Files and 9/11 and Jericho, of course, and World War Hulk and Civil War, and basically the rise of the police state in sci-fi, which, of course, as a sidebar, if you look at the recent Oscars, is basically all stories of conspiracies and war and police states and murder and death and violence. If we jump to newsblaze.com, there's a little op-ed, Flight 93 Memorial, a tribute to terrorists. And it's basically a writer named Pamela Duffy griping about a Flight 93 Memorial, the International Freedom Center. It's a proposed museum to be located adjacent to the site of Ground Zero. It was selected in 2004 to comprise a cultural space, and I believe it faces Mecca, which makes people angry. But of course, last week we covered the Arizona 9/11 Memorial. But if we jump yet again, I think I was trying to keep score. I think this is the third time that former president and MENA, Arkansas drug runner Bill Clinton has been confronted with 9/11 truth. So Bill Clinton responded to an Investigate 9/11 sign during an Austin rally on the 27th as mobs of people in the crowd shouted for the sign to be put down and still others tore the 9/11 sign away. Clinton told the crowd, "It's an honor to be heckled by people who are afraid of the truth." True doublespeak. And you can watch that clip. It's a lot of yelling and screaming. It's more interesting to watch, but it's our man Matt Dayton, who scored yet another great showing for 9/11 truth. There's an accompanying article by Steve Watson, Bill Clinton, The Decline of an Elitist Puppet, and it basically tracks his recent downfall in the public's eyes. Bill Clinton shamed in public confrontation. Bill Clinton takes on 9/11 conspiracy protesters. Bill Clinton confronted by WeAreChange.org, and more and more and more. We mentioned last week the rally from ailing 9/11 first responders. If we jump to NewYorkDailyNews.com, sick 9/11 workers in rainy rally in D.C., chanting 25 million isn't enough. Dozens of sick 9/11 first responders stood in the rain on Capitol Hill Tuesday, the 26th, and urged President Bush to restore funding to help pay their medical bills. And Dennis Kucinich, the only candidate most aligned with 9/11 truth, was there at the rally. There's also a report from NY1.com. 9/11 first responders traveled to D.C. to request more funding. That also has an audio-video link for you. If we jump to 911blogger.com, there is a new German documentary called Unter falscher Flagge, which I believe is Under a False Flag. It's now been subtitled in English, and so I posted up the video for you. It's pretty damn good. It's got a lot of German military and political insiders. And then we have from UniquePakistan.com, headline, September 11th may have been an insider's job. In a significant observation, many-time UN contributor and international observer Professor Hans Kochler, K-O-E-C-H-L-E-R, said 9/11 may have been an insider's job in response to a question from one of the delegates attending his lecture, The Global War on Terror, Contradictions of an Imperial Strategy, that was at the Trades Hall in Auckland, New Zealand last week. I'm not a boy, I'm 59. There are many inconsistencies and inaccuracies in the official version of those events. Those who could not handle a Cessna pulled off 9/11. But he was quick to note that the official version has to be challenged. Quoting David Ray Griffin, he said, "These events, in terms of the destruction caused, these incidents cannot have been exclusively organized by a shadowy network of mujahideen from the remote places of the globe. The causes officially given for the incident are not a sufficient explanation for what actually happened that day, especially as regards the logistics of this highly sophisticated operation and the very advanced infrastructure required for it." So Kochler's published more than 300 books, reports, and scholarly articles. In his book, The Global War on Terror and the Metaphysical Enemy, he writes the atrocities of September 11th, instead of dealing with the contradictions and inconsistencies in the official version of events and the numerous gaps in terms of factual information, it's a dogma of political correctness that's been promulgated, according to which 19 Islamic-inspired Arab hijackers, directed by an elusive Al-Qaeda or base, database, succeeded in carrying out the atrocities all by themselves. And so they also mention Yukihisa Fujita, Japan's House of Counselors or the Senate, and basically goes on to document the fact that worldwide the 9/11 truth movement is in full force. It may not feel like it so much here in America, it's kind of slowed down, but internationally it's kicking. So speaking internationally, we had a couple interesting anniversaries this last week. We had the 75th anniversary of the original Reichstag fire. 75 years ago, on the 27th of February, Hitler and the Nazis blamed the burning of the Reichstag Parliament building in Berlin on communist/terrorist. Despite lack of evidence, and less than a month later, the Enabling Act was passed, giving Hitler dictatorial powers. It didn't take much longer after 9/11 for the Bush gang to get their Patriot Act. Anyone who refuses to see the parallels must be deaf, dumb, and blind. The other anniversary of this last week, last Tuesday, while the 9/11 first responders were rallying for more money, they were near the site on the 15th anniversary of World Trade Center attack number one.
Recapping now for you once again, if you've just joined us, an explosion underground in the garage section of the World Trade Center in New York City has killed now three people, according to the New York Port Authority, and has injured at least 150 people. Hundreds of people, as we speak, are still being evacuated from the twin-story towers of the structure and a hotel in the complex as well at the southern tip of Manhattan Island. There were reports earlier of some people being trapped under the rubble. We do understand that's where at least two of the fatalities were found. There are still people trapped in the two towers, as we say, but EMS and firefighting personnel are at least to the 85th floor of the Twin Towers evacuating these people. They're also being taken off the roof by helicopter.
Last winter, the FBI was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people. Correspondent Jacqueline Adams has the story.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. Discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Emad Salem. Unbeknownst to the FBI at the time, Salem recorded many of his conversations with his handlers.
I'm holding 903 pages of draft transcripts.
William Kunstler represents Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and several others charged with conspiring to blow up a series of New York City landmarks 4 months after the World Trade Center bombing. That case has not yet gone to trial. Kunstler confirmed newspaper reports of the Salem transcripts. In one, Salem complains to an FBI agent, "Since the bomb went off, I feel terrible. I feel bad. I feel here is people who don't listen." The agent replies, "Hey, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't try and I didn't try. You can't force people to do the right thing."
There is material in here to show gross governmental misconduct.
Today, attorneys for the defendants in the ongoing World Trade Center bombing case formally asked for the transcripts of Salem's tapes.
Quite frankly, beyond me, why now, the fourth week into the trial, we still don't have these materials.
Prosecutors have refused to comment publicly, but legal experts say the defense may have no right to those transcripts.
It's not a defense to a crime to say, if only the government had stopped me, I wouldn't have done it. So this is material that ordinarily the defense would be entitled to.
In court today, a witness from the Ford Motor Company linked debris recovered from the explosion site to a Ford van where defendant Mohammed Salamat was arrested less than a week after the bombing. Jacqueline Adams, CBS News, New York.
Ahmad Salem is former Egyptian army officer and the government's star witness against Egyptian cleric Dr. Omar Abdelrahman, who the FBI says was the ringleader in the bombing plot. Salem was paid an estimated $1.5 million to infiltrate and inform Rahman and his followers. He was recruited shortly after the 1991 assassination of right-wing Rabbi Meir Kahane. As an associate of Rahman, Salem traveled in the cleric's inner circle, where he surreptitiously recorded conversations with Rahman. But unknown to his FBI handlers at the time, Salem also recorded his dealings with the government. A newspaper article revealed the existence of the tapes, and the Reuters news agency received written transcripts. A copy of one of the most revealing conversations between Ahmad Salem and an FBI agent named John was recently acquired by WBAI. In that conversation, Salem demands more money from the FBI, outlining his contributions to the agency, including a cryptic statement by Salem to the FBI. Salem says, "We know the bombs start to be built by your confidential informant." According to a source close to the case, Ahmad Salem checked into a Manhattan hospital 3 hours after the blast, complaining of a severe ringing in his ears. A hospital spokesperson refuses to confirm or deny the report. Salem also mentions a defendant convicted in the World Trade Center bombing, Mohammed Aboulima, a man Salem says he located in Egypt for the FBI. The first voice is Ahmad Salem, the second FBI agent, John.
Everything was submitted with a receipt.
Yeah.
And now it's questionable.
It's not questionable. It's like a little out of ordinary.
Okay.
You know.
Right. I don't think it was. If that's what you think, that is fine. But I don't think that, because we was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the DA, and we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb start to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case. And then he put his head in the sand and said, "Oh, no, that's not true. He is son of a bitch." Okay. It's built with a different way in another place, and that's it.
WTC 93 was an inside job, documented fully. And so we just heard Ahmad Salem, ex-Egyptian army officer turned FBI informant, who was a key witness in the trial of Ramzi Youssef, Abdul Hakim Murad, and Wali Khan Amin Shah, convicted in the World Trade Center bombing of February 26, 1993. Salem taped his conversations with FBI agent John Anticev, A-N-T-I-C-E-V. A related story from the AP, appropriately enough, in this last week, 93 World Trade Center bomber seeks Supreme Court hearing. 15 years after the 93 WTC bombing, a Palestinian sentenced to more than 100 years in prison in the attack claims that a vengeful U.S. government has blocked him from appealing to a U.S. Supreme Court. Ahmad Mohammed Ajaj, AJAJ, who remains in extreme isolation in the most secure U.S. prison, that's the old Florida Supermax, filed a lawsuit last year in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan against more than a dozen judges, federal court employees, Bureau of Prison officials, and his former defense lawyer, Miranda Fritz. He said they failed to notify him of appeals court rulings and blocked his access to what he would have needed for a Supreme Court appeal of his conviction on conspiracy charges in the February 26, 1993 bombing. I have Ahmad Ajaj Wikipedia bio, and you can read about that, but it was the 15th anniversary, and the FBI had foreknowledge of the World Trade Center attack in 93, documented. If we jump to The Guardian, yet again, 9/11 victims identified from new DNA. A fresh effort to identify victims of the 9/11 attacks in the World Trade Center is underway in New York following the discovery of fragments of human remains in the area around Ground Zero. So far, a handful of people whose remains were not found in the initial trawl through the rubble have been identified. But forensic scientists hope that when DNA identification begins in earnest, more victims will be found. This all came from scientists at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Scientists in D.C. last Saturday. Interestingly enough, The Guardian is the only news service I can find that is carrying the story about new DNA identifications. We've made numerous links to previously identified victims. We also have new IDs that have come out of this project. Once the DNA testing really comes full circle, it will be fascinating to see how many new IDs we get. If we jump to a 9/11 blogger yet again, we are change. Or rather, oh, I misspoke. It's Philly. Philly 9/11 Truth confronted ex-mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, about the early low-key warning he got the night before September 11th. Now, we all know, of course, about John Ashcroft. He got warnings not to fly. Willie Brown also got a phone call from his, quote, security people at the airport warning him not to fly, and he was confronted, and he gets quite uncomfortable. And so you can hit up that story, Who Warned Willie Brown, from 911blogger.com. There's a good article, an op-ed piece from Mark H. Gaffney up on thepeoplesvoice.org. Unraveling of the official 9/11 story continues, and it basically documents how the story is crumbling day by day. Last week, we covered an article called Rule by Fear or Rule by Law by an ex-congressman named Daniel Hamburg. It ran in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it basically detailed that KBR is building detention centers, and they have trains reportedly with shackles. And it was a major, major article documenting the emerging police state to run in a major mainstream newspaper. So last week, as I was doing episode 64, Daniel Hamburg was on the Alex Jones Show talking about his article, Rule by Law or Rule by Fear.
The way I got interested in this particular issue was looking at some of the things our local sheriff, our local county sheriff was involved in. I just noticed an article on the front page of our local paper in which the sheriff was requisitioning these storage facilities that were going to be placed in strategic locations around the county. And he was asking county residents to contribute to an inventory of equipment that was in their possession so that it could be used in the case of an emergency. And it just kind of piqued my interest, and, you know, I started wondering, well, you know, what does this have to do with, you know, the job of a local county sheriff? What's the linkage between this kind of activity and the Department of Homeland Security? What kinds of, you know, I knew, you know, back to the Ollie North days, that there were plans to incarcerate citizens in the case of civil unrest. You know, a lot of this is hardly new. And as you point out, when you have when you have a country that's basically being run by the military and by its industrial components, this kind of thing is going to be both profitable and, you know, and efficacious. I mean, they're going to need a way to deal with people when they get out of line in large numbers. And, of course, back in the 80s, the fear was that if the Reagan administration invaded Central America, there would be a mass uprising or protest against that, and they needed places to take people to, you know, in order to make sure that civil unrest could be contained. So I knew none of this was new, but certainly since 9/11, you know, and that's where I begin my article, this has all been stepped up. I do want to address, Alex, if I could, one other thing you asked, which I think is an interesting question, is how did we get this article in the Chronicle? Because, you know, you can go to the internet and Google in any of these terms and you'll get, you know, thousands and thousands of hits. But my goal from the beginning in researching and writing this article was to get it into a mainstream newspaper, because I knew if it did, it would be much harder for people to say, oh, this is just, you know, more internet BS. And the reason that happened is because Mr. Seiler and myself have been writing for the Chronicle for over 10 years, and we've had some pretty hard-hitting articles in it, but nothing as provocative as this one. And it was mainly because of a long relationship with the editorial page editor. Well, you know, the piece was, you know, had quite a few footnotes, and, you know, we could point to exactly where we got all the information. But still, for a major mainstream newspaper to say that, let's see, what was that, that the government has contracted with companies to build thousands of rail cars, some equipped with shackles to transport detainees, I don't think a sentence like that has been in any other mainstream newspaper in the country to date.
Ex-Congressman Daniel Hamburg speaking on the Alex Jones Show last week about his article in the San Francisco Chronicle, Rule by Fear or Rule by Law. And that brings to a close another frightening episode of MediaMonarchy.com. This was episode 65, February 29th, 2008, Leap Day, coming to you from praradio.org and revereradionetwork.com. As I recount to you each week, I keep a list of creepy visitors that hit up MediaMonarchy.com. In the last week, we had Georgia Public Library Services Googled Anderson Cooper Bohemian Grove. The Embassy of China in Washington, D.C. Googled U.S. Embassy in Belgrade Overrun. Health and Welfare Agency Data Center Googled Manchurian Candidate Pilots 9/11. U.S. Department of State Googled U.S. Office Kosovo Overran. NASA was reading about JFK's son, Jack Worthington, which we went over here previously. Halliburton was visiting the page from my link on sourcewatch.org, and they were reading about torture, rape, and videotape. The Seattle Cancer Care Alliance hit me up from a link on blacklistednews.com. Trenton State College Googled GPS and RFID surveillance. Somebody at Dartmouth College hit me up from my link on aftermathnews.wordpress.com. The National Science Foundation, NSF.gov, hit me up from Googling urban warfare training in Ohio. Boeing Googled spy RFID satellite. ConocoPhillips Googled Willis 5 JFK. And they were basically reading about how Bruce Willis, in a recent issue of Vanity Fair, said that the people who killed JFK are still in power running the shadow government. The DEA visited four times. The Lehman Brothers Googled New Jersey Guard to deploy. Hewlett-Packard Googled Outside the Box 140. Honeywell International Googled Taxi documentary, of course reading about Taxi to the Dark Side, the Oscar winner for Best Documentary this year. Detroit Edison were reading about military connections to the Omaha shooting. Northrop Grumman, of course, was reading about their B-2 crash. Kmart was reading again about New Jersey to deploy the largest amount of National Guard members since World War II. Someone at my old alma mater, Shepherd University, Googled Ed Herendeen, and they were reading about how the theater director there in Shepherdstown at the Contemporary American Theater Festival caught a lot of flack last summer for staging My Name is Rachel Corey. Kansas State University Googled terrorize students drill. And finally, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service Googled blue nun dies. I don't know what they were looking for, but it probably wasn't about Sister Cindy Mahoney, the nun and first responder at Ground Zero who died from the toxic dust. My friends, I thank you for joining me. You know, something Alex Ansari was getting into, and something he does mention, is that this luxury of the internet and of the web and of streaming and of podcasts and of all these things and blogs and MySpace and me being able to talk to you through the radio show and through the website every day and every week could disappear like that. So we better use it while we got it, my friends. But I'll be back next week for you. PRARadio.org, RevereRadioNetwork.com, MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.